supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A new report out of Philadelphia tries to quantify the financial strain created when a student moves from a traditional public school to a charter. The analysis suggests the fiscal hit is not as big as many once thought. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Uri Munson, the school district of Philadelphia's top finance guy, wants you to imagine a football field. Let's say this field was built for a school with 500 kids. And let's say 25 of those kids leave the school for a new charter.
Even if you lose 5% of your children, doesn't mean you now need a football field that's 95 yards long instead of 100 yards long. You still need that 100-yard football field.
This is a classic case of what education wonks call a stranded cost. A student leaves for a charter, but the district still has to pay for all sorts of stuff and staff that the kid left behind.
Even though one student leaves, you still have a teacher for the classroom. You still have a principal for the school, you still have counselors, still have nurses.
In 2012, a firm studied Philly's finances and estimated that for each kid leaving for a charter, the district is stuck with $7,000 in stranded costs. In a city with 70,000 charter students, that's a big deal. But in 2015, the district commissioned a new study to look a little closer at the books. This new group of consultants found that each new charter seat only creates $4,800 in stranded costs. That's significantly less, says charter advocate Mike Wang of Philadelphia School Advocacy Partners.
Even the number that they cite in the report is less by a third. It's under $5,000 compared to $7,000. That's a big difference.
And there's another important number in this analysis. The consulting group Afton Partners said that about 60% of all stranded costs could be wiped out if the school district closed schools that are less than half full. In other words, these stranded costs aren't stranded forever. They can be reduced if a shrinking school district faces reality and downsizes.
You know, the only thing that's really stranded here are the families that the district's leaving stranded in underutilized and unsafe buildings by failing to make tough decisions.
Now, this report isn't saying the district will close more schools. And of course, closing schools in practice is really messy. The district learned that in 2013 when it closed 23 schools. Where will displaced children go? Will some neighborhoods be left totally without a school? What about the psychological blow? Donna Cooper of Public Citizens for Children and Youth says it's not as simple as closing schools that are more than half empty.
It's just not that easy to say, oh, but by the way, if you did this, this is what you would save. It's a little bit more complicated.
She also says that this new analysis makes one thing crystal clear. Adding new charter schools does cost money. Lots of money. Even if you want to say the cost is only $5,000 a seat, that's millions of dollars for a school district facing long-term deficits.
If we want to argue this forever and say it's $5,000, it's still a lot of money per student that we have to come up with. So these are actual costs that the district has to bear as students transfer to charter.
Ultimately, the numbers are really a mask for a broader argument. Does expanding charters seriously harm kids in the traditional public system? This latest analysis won't decide the issue, but it will certainly fuel the debate. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf announced today that his office is taking IBM to court. Wolf's lawsuit contends that millions in taxpayer dollars were spent on upgrades to the state's unemployment computer system, but the tech giant never delivered. More from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
In 2013, years after Pennsylvania hired IBM to streamline the unemployment intake system, there was a problem.
You know, the project was over 40 months behind and $60 million over budget and has led to the department using a system that is clearly outdated.
That's J.J. Abbott, spokesman for Governor Wolf. He says the contract with IBM was scrapped at that point, but the costs of maintaining the creaky system kept mounting. The lawsuit, filed in state court in Harrisburg, accuses IBM of breach of contract, negligence, and fraud. The state hopes to get its money back and then some.
Pennsylvania taxpayers paid IBM nearly $170 million for a system that was supposed to be comprehensive and integrative and modern, but they never got it.
Abbott says for people applying for unemployment, the alleged IBM fiasco is really bad news. The department overseeing unemployment was recently forced to lay off 500 employees and close 3 call centers. An old computer system adds to the troubles. Through a spokesman, IBM said the governor's suit has no merit and that the company will vigorously defend itself. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
It's a crowded field of 7 candidates vying to be the Democratic pick to replace Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies is sitting down with all of them, and today he talks with former federal prosecutor Joe Kahn.
Well, Joe Kahn, welcome to Newsworks Tonight. When you have 60 seconds to tell somebody on their front porch why you're the right guy for this job, what's your pitch?
I'm a lifelong Philadelphian who's dedicated his life to seeking justice for Philadelphia, and that's what the city needs in its district attorney. We don't have a DA who's seeking justice for all Philadelphians, especially people who are the most vulnerable, the most exploited, the most afraid to come forward and report crime. And that's one of the biggest problems we have in the city right now, is that so many of us take for granted the privilege that we have to be able to report a crime, and so many people are beyond the reach of the justice system. We need a DA who's going to look out for those folks too.
Okay, now the current DA, he's had his problems on ethical issues, but he has spent his career in the district attorney's office, prosecuted a lot of cases. In what way is he not looking out for justice for Philadelphians?
Unfortunately, the current DA has allowed a culture of statistics and easy wins to drive the office. And so a lot of times what that's meant is taking on easy fights so that the DA can point to a 99% success rate. And I don't think that's how you measure success. I think that we need to be judged by how we treat the least among us, whether that's people that are sitting in prison because they shouldn't be, or people who are being victimized but have no voice. And the district attorney needs to be doing both. And right now the city needs a progressive prosecutor who has progressive values that will make sure we have equal justice for everyone in the city, but also the prosecutorial experience to make sure we can achieve that vision for all Philadelphians.
Give us an example of easy cases he shouldn't take on or tougher cases he should.
Sure. The easiest example are these low-level drug offenses where people are caught being in possession of drugs, and the DA can tout that in 100% or 99% of the cases in which he prosecutes people for drug possession, he's getting convictions. They're not that hard to prosecute, but they're not really doing much to deal with the serious problem of addiction. They're not doing very much to deal with the more significant problem in terms of the supply side and the dealing side with doctors who are illegally prescribing opiates, which are tough fights to take on, people who are trafficking drug addicts and bringing them to Philadelphia under false pretenses, taking on big drug kingpins and organized crime. Those are tougher fights that the DA isn't taking on when he's pointing to these high win rates for drug offenses.
A lot of people feel too many people are waiting in prison for trial, in some cases people who will never be convicted. What would you do about our system of bail?
So, you know, we're just a block away from the federal courthouse where I spent 10 years, and this problem was solved fairly easily in terms of how we dealt with the question of detention. If someone came into federal court and they were simply too dangerous to be let out of prison, or they were just too much of a flight risk in a fairly serious case, then we weren't going to let them out. But for everyone else, if there was some kind of combination of conditions that would reasonably assure both the safety of the community and this person's appearance in court, then we would find it. And we wouldn't set some arbitrary number or some amount of dollars based on what was on a grid and wait until that person could raise the money and let them languish in prison until they got out. That's not how we treated people. And there's no reason we can't have that kind of system in the local courts.
We've talked about bail. We've talked about low-level drug offenses. Give me another priority.
I think we need to still move the conversation to the questions of who is not being reached by the justice system. And when I think about all the people who are afraid to report crimes because they fear retaliation, they fear the police, they fear deportation, I want to make sure that we have a district attorney that's standing up for them. So many of the cases that I handled as a prosecutor were the most vulnerable victims you can imagine, victims of child abuse, of sexual assault, of child exploitation and domestic violence. Right now, we don't have a DA who's speaking up for those folks. The current district attorney has underfunded the prosecution of those cases by a substantial margin. The first thing I'm going to do on day one as district attorney is I'm going to reverse that trend. I'm going to restore full funding to the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Unit, where I was a prosecutor during my time at the DA's office.
Mayor Kenney's made Philadelphia what's called a sanctuary city. The city does not routinely honor detainer requests from immigration when they have someone in custody that immigration would like them to hold. What's your view of this?
As a prosecutor, I'm not going to cooperate with Donald Trump's immigration agenda. Number one, as a district attorney, you need to take an oath to the Constitution. And I'm not going to in any way enable a process that, in my view, clearly violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, in which we have a president who's made clear that he has particular views of whether people from a certain religious background, that is Muslims, should be allowed in this country. And I'm the son of a Muslim immigrant. The president has made clear what his views are about the kind of people that Mexico sends to this country and where he wants to focus his priorities. I will in no way enable that program, number one. Number two, I want to make sure that as a district attorney that I am making sure we do everything we can to make people feel safe, to make people know that if they are the victim of a crime, that they can trust law enforcement. And what I don't want to see is the Philadelphia Police Department being turned into the henchmen of Donald Trump's immigration force. And I'm not going to do anything that's going to perpetuate that reality or that image by doing things that are going to make it easier for people to feel that when they see a police officer, that immigration could be next.
Thanks so much for being with us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much.
Democratic candidate for Philadelphia District Attorney Joe Kahn spoke with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Over the next few weeks, we'll hear from the others on the ballot. Asperger's Are Us, a comedy troupe of self-described openly autistic people, performs Sunday in Philadelphia. As WHYY's Ann Hoffman reports, their comedy is not about spreading awareness.
Asperger's R Us is a four-person sketch comedy group from the Boston area. Inspired by groups like The Kids in the Hall and Monty Python, New Michael Injimi and Noah Britton described their style as absurd. Here's how they responded during our interview when I told them they weren't live on the air.
We finally passed on.
Well, then I guess I can put my hand into this furnace. It won't matter.
Britton says being on the autism spectrum can be an asset when it comes to comedy.
You know, it makes us have very associative brains, so we can make puns so much quicker than a lot of neurotypicals because they're thinking of stuff more linearly.
Britton, who got his diagnosis when he was 20, met the other members of the troupe when he was their counselor at a camp for kids on the spectrum.
At the time, I was like, oh, these people get it. This is fun. This makes sense. This is intrinsically motivating. And I'd go home and be so happy from cracking up with them all day.
Injimi and Britton say don't come to their show expecting a crash course in autism. Come to have fun and enjoy the absurd sketches, like the one about a couple looking to adopt a foster kid, only to meet their own biological child, whom they gave up before.
Mom? Dad?
And though the troupe doesn't like it when people come to, quote, expand their horizons, if that does happen, they say, it's not the end of the world.
Because money doesn't care where it comes from. We'll use it to buy stuff no matter what.
Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
This is Championship Week, the lead up to Selection Sunday, setting up the brackets for March Madness starting Thursday. 64 teams vying for a flight to Phoenix to participate in the Final Four April 1st. Let's punch our ticket with Philadelphia Daily News sports columnist Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, David. Proud to be here.
Defending champion Villanova. Let's talk about their fortunes going in. They seem to be recovered from that loss to Butler, their second loss to Butler this season.
Yeah, and they lost to Marquette in January as well, and that cost them the number one ranking, but it might not cost them the number one overall seed, depending how Kansas does, and it's, you know, as it finishes its season. So it's fascinating that the Villanova team has changed as well. It lost some significant players, but it might have the player of the year in Josh Hart, and probably one of the five best coaches coaching right now in the NCAA basketball.
And so much like perhaps Popovich in the pros, is it more the system rather than the players in the system that makes Villanova as good as they are year after year?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because yes and no. Yes, because it is the system. You have to play a certain way for Jay Wright or you don't play. The ethos at Villanova for basketball is they take the sort of second-tier player, nurture them, and develop them into superior college basketball players who may never have the athleticism or be able to play above the rim or get up and down or have the size of the guys who do go to the NBA very quickly. But when they're juniors and seniors in college, they're a joy to watch.
Speak, if you will, to the college landscape 2017 versus, say, when Villanova prevailed way back in 1985 and the dividend that accrues to the school with emerging as the champ or in the Final Four.
Well, in the late 70s, early 80s, college basketball became a TV sport and an entertainment cash cow because the overhead's incredibly low. The product is found and the stars are essentially in servitude. So you have this entity that if you can sell people on its excitement and get them to identify with a team, especially a national following like a North Carolina or a Duke or a Kansas, you're not necessarily alumni driven, you're nationally driven. You become a brand. And that's what happened. If you hit like Raleigh Massimino did and become a Massimino or a Valvano, that is invaluable to your university. Your admissions department loves you, because applications increase, you can increase tuition, you get your alumni association loves you, because you're talking about tens of millions in the 80s and hundreds of millions of dollars in increased donations from a very proud alumni base. And you can improve your college, you can expand your university, you can attract more accomplished professors, you can do more research, and of course you can pay the basketball coach even more.
And again, as you say, all in the context of the players in servitude. Exactly. We'll take that topic up at another time. Let's move on to the pros. Why in early March am I rooting for the Sixers to lose as many games as possible? And similarly, I presume fans in Los Angeles and Phoenix and Orlando are doing the same. What's wrong with the NBA?
Well, I don't know if it's wrong that you're doing that, because you are engaged. The NBA had a chance, I think two seasons ago, to change the lottery system so you didn't play to lose. They chose not to, in part because they don't really mind the publicity. Because
I think I would mind if I was season ticket holder plunking down $100 for games that are meaningless.
Right, but they don't really care about season ticket holders as much as they care about viewership.
With question marks about Embiid's health, the Sixers are going to have to decide soon whether to commit to him to a longer-term deal. And I've heard some talk that it's an open-ended question.
It very much is. The bone bruise that has cost him 15 or 16 games is coming along nicely, but the meniscus tear that they thought was less important has either degraded or was worse than they thought. Neither injury is particularly serious. However, the catalog of injuries, from the back issue he had in college to the 2-foot procedures he had to have as a professional to the knee injuries, plural, that have knocked him out of this season, give you pause to think, okay, I know he's young and his body is still growing and he's adjusting to it, but when does it stop? When does he stop becoming a casualty? He's played 31 games in 3 years. The disappointment with Joel Embiid missing the rest of this season, compounded by the fact that the number one overall pick, that the super tank, the 3-year tank was enacted for, Ben Simmons, this generational transformative talent, has a broken foot that hasn't healed quickly and doesn't look like it's going to heal quickly enough for him to even really give you a taste of what he can do in summer league ball. You have to be, if you're a Sixers fan, think that your organization is just jinxed.
Philadelphia Daily News sports columnist Marcus Hayes on Newsworks Tonight. The annual Philadelphia Flower Show opens this weekend at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. Each year, the largest and oldest flower show in the country has a theme. And this year, that theme is Holland. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins offers this preview.
Inside the Pennsylvania Convention Center, landscape architects and floral designers put final touches on their interpretation of what Holland looks like. And overwhelmingly, that means bridges and bicycles.
It was one of the first things that we thought of when we considered what we would do for this show. It was the first thing that came to mind, bicycles, and then tulips.
That is Lauren Hilburn, a designer with the Hunter Hayes Landscape Company based in Ardmore. She created a bridge made of bicycle parts that spans a pond with its own kinetic water fountain that's made of, can you guess, more bicycle parts. And she's not the only one. The main entrance to the Philadelphia Flower Show, the splashy wow piece you first see when you enter the hall, is a bridge enveloped by thousands of tulips, and on its railing are locked about a dozen bicycles. One floral designer welded hundreds of bike parts together into a dense tangle and then suspended it in the air like a canopy. But Carrie Preston, shows us that Holland is not just bridges and bicycles. The New Jersey native studied horticulture in Bucks County and then went to Holland, where she's been working as a landscape architect for 2 decades.
There's states in the north of the Netherlands where you have century-old meadows of naturalizing bulbs.
Naturalizing bulbs are tulips that can propagate themselves year after year. While they might not have the flashy flowers of the commercially farmed bulbs that Holland is famous for, and Netherlands is the world's largest exporter of flowers, but given the right conditions, they can really take over space. The landscape Preston designed for the flower show looks like a formal classic garden overrun with wild tulips, all wrapped in a chain-link fence.
And that's sort of the American twist on this very sort of Dutch landscape. So it has a very symmetrical classic architecture that you'd see at one of those estates. And then we added the chain link, which is very much the vernacular in the U.S.
The centerpiece of the flower show is a geodesic dome designed for the Dutch government. For a year, it was on display in Amsterdam, showcasing design innovations and technologies developed by the Dutch for more environmentally sustainable living. Things like an air purification system and a passive cooling system involving large panels of moss. It was designed by Nico Wessing, who says a truly Dutch garden should not be made of tulips and water fountains, but rather of reclaimed material from wherever you happen to be.
We are traveling a lot of products all over the world, all the stones, natural stones from China and pebbles from India and tropical forest wood. We disturb the environment. We are not friendly to the earth. Well, so if you like to make your own landscape, your own garden, your own design, try to be very close and balanced well to nature.
The garden he designed for the flower show features some plants that are native to the Philadelphia region. The flower show runs until March 19th. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Tomorrow's match day for medical students and the residencies they hope to receive. Tomorrow evening, we'll look at whether hospitals will be reluctant to make offers to students from countries named in the president's travel ban. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.